Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde. Ich begrüße Sie zu dieser Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, gut gelaunt, und zwar aus Serbien. Ich staune ja selber immer wieder, wohin mich mein Leben verschlägt. Auf jeden Fall befinde ich mich jetzt im White Palace, also im weißen Palast der serbischen Königsfamilie. Und Serbien war ja eine Monarchie, die dann sehr brutal abgewürgt wurde, vor ja, etwas über 80 Jahren, damals in den Zusammenhängen des Zweiten Weltkriegs. Die Königsfamilie, die monarchische Familie allerdings, hat sich dann im Exil am Leben gehalten und hat sozusagen außerhalb Serbiens ihre Existenz weitergeführt. Es ist eine große Ehre und eine große Freude, dass ich heute den Stammhalter, den Kronprinzen, aber er nennt sich hier korrekterweise den Erbprinzen von Serbien, begrüßen darf aus der berühmten Familie der Karadjordjevic. Ich hoffe, ich habe das richtig ausgesprochen. Es ist Erbprinz Philipp von Serbien. Und ich werde mit ihm auf Englisch dann diese Konversation führen, aber wir müssen wissen, Prinz Philipp hat eine enge Beziehung auch zur Schweiz, denn er ist ein Absolvent unter anderem der Hotelfachschule in Lausanne. I was just explaining, yes, that you made one of our proudest schools, our best schools, die Hotelfachschule, sozusagen die ETH der Gastronomie. Er hat auch andere Fächer studiert, ist in der Finanzbranche tätig gewesen und nun mit seiner Familie, seiner jungen Frau, seinen Kindern leben sie jetzt in Serbien und haben hier auch repräsentative Pflichten zu erfüllen. Wir werden mit ihm über all diese Themen sprechen, über Serbien, über die Monarchie und auch über die Faszinationskraft dieses Landes, über das ja in den Medien sehr viele Missverständnisse auch herumgeistern. So, jetzt werde ich aber switchen auf Englisch. Dear Hereditary Prince, I'm sorry, this is a very complicated word for me to pronounce. I would prefer Crown Prince. He explained to me, Crown Prince is not correct. So I say Erbprinz, Hereditary Prince.
But actually, Crown Prince is correct.
It's correct.
If there was a monarchy here, my father would be king and I would be Crown Prince.
But if you would, if you would say you were the Crown Prince, would this mean that your family would start to reinstall the monarchy in Serbia?
It would mean that maybe the monarchy would be reinstalled in Serbia and my father would be king.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, it's great. Thank you very much that we can take your time
thank
here.
Thank you very much for coming here. Welcome to the White Palace, the Beli Dvor in Belgrade, and welcome to Serbia.
Well, fantastic. Your accent is perfect. You have been living a long time in England, but I think you have been born in the United States of
Correct.
America.
Yes. So my father was essentially born in exile in London. And I was born when he moved to the States with my mother. He married Princess Maria da Gloria Orleans Braganza, no. who is a Brazilian princess with also Spanish and French royal roots from the Orleans Braganza mm-hmm. family. And they married in 1972. And in 1980, they had my older brother in Chicago. And then 2 years later, myself and my twin brother Alex were born in Washington, D.C.
Okay. But you spent your first years in the
America,
United States?
Yeah, or? 2 years, a year and a half in the States. Then my parents separated, and then I moved with my brothers to Sevilla, Spain, where my mother remarried to El Duque de Segorbe, Ignacio.
So you speak Spanish too?
Hablamos en español.
Okay.
Oh, no, but we speak in English. I lived in Spain for several years, and a decision was made that we would then move to London to be with my father, and he remarried, and so to be with my father and stepmother in London, and that's where most of my education and life was spent in London, up until, let's say, 2017, when I met my to-be wife, mm-hmm. and that shook my world completely, and then 3 years later, I moved back to finally moved to Belgrade for good, and that was during the COVID pandemic in 2020, June 2020.
Okay, interesting that you stayed in England. England is like the epitome of royalty, especially in Europe. I mean, the royals are highly regarded, and Queen Elizabeth, of course, was like a secular hero of our world. And as far as I've learned, she was actually the godmother of your father.
My father's godmother, Queen Elizabeth, she was very respected, one of the longest reigning monarchs ever, and she really embodied what constitutional monarch is about, and that is that neutrality and figurehead and unwavering apolitical above politics ideology, what a constitutional monarch should uphold. Mm-hmm. And she held a straight face for so many years, but went through so much.
Yeah.
And so yes, there's a connection to the British royal family. My father is connected, knows Prince Charles, King Charles III. Now, as you were, he's of Orthodox descendants as well. His father, Queen Elizabeth's husband, Prince Philip, is of the Greek royal family.
And so there is the Orthodox tie.
And so he has a certain pride of his Orthodox background, and he's visited Svetagora, which is the Mount Athos, the holy autonomous region in Greece. And there was a time when Helander, our monastery, had a terrible accident, and half of it burnt down.
Okay.
And he helped to raise money to restore it.
Okay.
So this is something that we're trying to work on, and trying to reignite his Orthodox roots.
I mean, it's interesting. I guess you had the privilege to meet the queen, the deceased queen.
I did a few times, but my father many more times, as he was his godmother.
And
he was there for my father's 50th birthday in Claridge's.
Okay.
And
what's your impression? I mean, what is the most specific and admirable trait about her? What did you see from vicinity, from probably encountering her?
No, I mean, I didn't know her well at all, because I only met her just a handful of times, but she had a good sense of humor. I remember speaking with her, my father, my brothers in the presence, and she was very quick and witty.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
There are a lot of, articles and comments on the royal family, all the turmoils and the difficulties they have within the family are talked about in public. What is, according to you, the greatest misunderstanding, you could say, that the public misunderstanding about the royal family of Great Britain?
Well, I think they're misunderstood because they're just a normal family. But of course, as a functioning royal family, you have it's not unwanted attention, but you are on the spotlight, and you have a role, and your role is to represent the country, to uphold the traditions, to uphold the customs, the values of your culture, and that requires a certain responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And if you deviate from the said responsibilities, then I guess the media will remind you. Obviously, not all media, but some medias, more left-leaning medias, might want to remind you and try and say you're irrelevant these days. But I think they've done a fantastic job to withhold their position. And even watching TV shows like The Crown, which I watched with my wife, I thought they did a very good job to show how difficult it is to be a monarch, but also how important it is. Even later in the show, yes, the show is very dramatized. It probably doesn't follow the true story with anything, but it's, I think, a reminder of how difficult it is to be a monarch and how to hold your position when times are changing all the time.
Yeah. What would you say does it mean to represent monarchy in today's world?
In today's world, well, we come from Serbia, and representing our monarchy in Serbia is that we differ ourselves from the British monarchy. We are a monarchy from the people, of the people. We were born from the first uprising against the Ottoman Empire in 1804, and that is my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Karađorđe Petrović, who led the first uprising against the Ottomans against all odds. He wasn't the first selected leader. He was actually the third selected leader that would lead the army that would finally uprise against Ottoman tyrannical rule that we were under in this region for many centuries. We were essentially their slaves. We were allowed to practice religion, but in quiet, in secret. And he led this for us. He was a he was chosen because of his strong leadership, and he was a very charismatic, and he took good decisions. And out of nowhere, in 1804, if you looked at the map, the sea of the Ottoman Empire, all of a sudden, this pop, Serbia pops up, and that's thanks to Karadjordje.
And he was the elected king.
He was a democratically elected monarch. And then there was a second uprising, which was led by the Obrenović dynasty. And so we had rival dynasties through the 19th century, which was the Karadjordjević family and the Obrenović family. Then the late, and then by the end of the century, it was the Karadjordjevićs who took over with King Peter I, my great-great-grandfather, who was one of Serbia's, if not Serbia's most beloved king. And who did many great things for Serbia, moving away from this influence of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and becoming much more independent, but also relying on good trades with not only the West, with the Brits and the French, but also with Russia, as we are very tied to Russia because of our Orthodox roots.
So he represented he was the Serbian way, you know, like, you know, a bridge between East and West.
He was a liberator. He also liberated Kosovo again in the Battle of Kosovo, in the dates are a bit iffy, but around 1910, 1912, before the First World War. He liberated Kosovo from the Ottoman rule. So he's known as the liberator.
And I mean, your family, your father, your they have been brought up in exile. They, it was not possible that the communists of Tito said, you know, we just, you know, we don't, we want to get rid of monarchy.
Well, it wasn't that simple.
But please, please correct me if I'm wrong.
So it was, so King Peter II was exiled in 1941, but his exile didn't come as willingly, it was by force. In 1943, he left the country in 1941 in exile, and he was still the functioning king, and, but then in 1943 there was a Tehran conference where the three axis of powers, so we're talking about Roosevelt, Churchill and Stalin, well, they pretty much got all the countries and the regions on a chopping board and said, okay, and Yugoslavia, you'd go under Russian influence. And that meant that we would, that our monarchy and everything that we were, our identity would be taken away, just like that, by a decision of the axis of three axis of powers.
And the point I was alluding to is, I mean, what does it mean also for you personally when you have been brought up in exile in this family, famous family, Serbian family, some kind of the embodiment of Serbian identity and of Serbian politics, of a very important element of Serbian politics. How have you been brought up? I mean, what was the ethos or the most important thing that, that your parents told you, which is you know, crucial to uphold? How did
I learned more about Serbia by moving here than I ever did through the teachings of my parents, because I think this is something that was broken and meant and was purposely broken to destroy the royal, the monarchy and the lineage through the inside. It wasn't until I met my wife, married and had my son on Serbian soil and moved to Serbia so my son could experience and live here for the first time, the first Karadjordje of male heir in this in Serbia, that I understood what it was to be a Serb. And that being a Serb is that we have these, character of resilience. For many centuries, we've always had to battle for the truth. We are people of honor. We are people of good morality. This is thanks to our Orthodox Christian roots, which is a very old form of Christianity, and we still practice that today, and that is our moral compass. And this is what's very important to uphold these traditions, Christian values, which is very attached to my ideology of strong family values. And this is something that I learned and strengthened while coming here to Serbia. And I think being a Serb is having this, what's known as Serbian inat. And inat is this strength. It's hard to describe in English. And inat is that willingness to go and tell the truth, to go and be a lead, and to go against the grind, the let's say the narrative of the world,
against the mainstream,
and show what we are about, and that is that we will not be that we're, that that the truth is the most important thing in life. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we've been bullied, pushed around by the bigger nations and all that. Mm-hmm. But we are still here. Yeah. We are very resilient people. We're very honest, loving people. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I've learned to love, to realize, and I fully embodied and cherished moving back to Serbia.
And how political can you be as an heir, you know? I mean, I guess there is, like in every country, it's always tense, you know, in politics, everybody goes against everybody, and then suddenly you have the representative of a very famous family. How open can you be? How intrusive can you be with your political opinions?
As a member of a royal family, we should be. I am above politics. I am apolitical. I approach with a neutral approach. But it's very difficult to be non-political in this world, because politics has actually managed to infiltrate mm-hmm. every aspect of our life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is thanks to the system that's been set up. So if anyone talks about anything, it's construed as you're talking about you're being political. Mm-hmm. So we have to walk a very tight diplomatic rhetoric of not disturbing too much when we talk about issues in this country. And especially that I'm living in the palace now with my wife. We only just recently moved here 3 weeks ago.
Okay.
So we have to show our uniting force. The family, the royal family, is there as a unifying force of all political spheres and ideologies. Mm-hmm. But that's what I mean. To answer your question, is the royal family is above politics. Yeah. And I would quote that maybe that what we should be heading towards, and I would say a reference to the book of Prince Hans Adam II, mm-hmm. who is the head of the Liechtenstein royal family. He wrote a book, The State in the Third Millennium, and he envisaged that the state should be that of a service company, and being a service to their people, and the royal family is that of us. Let's say representatives, custodians, caretakers of traditions, customs, and should be their duty should be that of foreign policy and other aspects. Yeah. And then the governing of the country, the governance should be more of a direct democracy, something similar to what you have in Switzerland. And this is why something I respect from Switzerland, one of the oldest republics in the world, and it's withheld its status as a strong democracy for many, many, many years, for centuries, since I believe the 11th, 12th century, because of the different decentralization of the cantons and of its ideology of direct democracy and having merit that leads the choices and not the other way around. Yeah. And this is what's happening to democracy these days, is that people are uninformed. So you have an uninformed majority making decisions and swaying what's happening in the public. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I can go on about this sort of.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, mentioning Switzerland, you have been living in Switzerland. You have done the Hotelfachschule in Lausanne, if I'm correct.
I was in Lausanne in Switzerland.
What was the impression? How did this shape your view of the world? To be in this, we call Switzerland. Switzerland is considered a direct democracy, but we Swiss we would actually call it is the best organized anarchy of the world. I mean, how did you encounter the anarchic spirit of the Swiss?
I wasn't very much aware of it when I was young. When I was there, it was 2008. I still find myself as a little bit naive, and I wasn't too interested in politics as a student. But it wasn't until recently, and I started studying more about politics and getting into what I'm now find myself a student of Austrian economics, and I'm an ardent reader.
Classical liberalism, you could say.
Yes, I say classical, even libertarian, but classical liberalism. Just like my great-great-grandfather, King Peter I, he was a classic liberal. Okay. He had John Stuart Mill's On Liberty.
Oh, right, he let it translate into Serbian, right.
Yes, that's true. So I come from that ideology, and this is something that's noticed back in Switzerland, as you said. Mm-hmm. And people associate the word anarchy with chaos, but it's actually no. Anarchy is actually to do with natural order and human action. And this is what I've studied in Switzerland and realized that Switzerland has a very good situation there with a decentralization of government. And this is something that I liked because it's something close to what I do as a profession. Yes, I represent the modern, my family, monarchy, and the number one is I'm a family man. I'm trying to be a good husband. I try to be a good father to my son Stefan, who's 6.5 years old, and my daughter Maria, who's 10 months old. And that's my number one duty. But then I have other roles, and one is that I'm an advocate of hard money, of Bitcoin. So
this is interesting. You said in an interview that Bitcoin represents freedom.
Bitcoin does represent freedom because it's all to do with the overarching thesis of Bitcoin is about private property, the protection of individual property rights. And the current system that we have now, the fiat system, as you're probably aware, the current system is known as the fiat system, and the fiat system is that of money that is not backed by anything hard. It's not backed by any energy. It's not backed by gold, by anything that's real. And so, the money supply is actually expanded at whim.
Yeah, that's like a prey of politicians. You know, they expand the money, so the money loses its value.
So as an individual who's working hard for his living, and then he's working to make his money and the money that he's saving, and then someone in some centralized power somewhere is then arbitrarily expanding the money supply, therefore eating away at the energy, his hard worked money, his actual savings are being slowly debased away. I find that incredibly unfair, and that is a direct violation of individual property rights.
I don't want to delve too much into that, but still, if you're a Bitcoin expert, probably just one remark. Sure. Many people are a bit afraid of Bitcoin because they don't understand how it works, and they say, well, it's insecure, you know, it's only on computer hard disks, and all your property can disappear. What can you say to the Bitcoin skeptics who are afraid? What is the counter-argument to that?
Bitcoin is actually tied to reality more than the fiat system is. Bitcoin is actually tied to reality through its mining process, which means it uses energy to mine, to create new Bitcoins. And that attachment to reality, to energy, is what makes it hard money. It means it's hard to reproduce more and to inflate it. It has a monetary schedule set in stone for many years. So it's the transactions of Bitcoins cannot be overrun by anyone, by any centralized party, anything. It's completely decentralized. And it is up to you as an individual to protect your coins. And this is where I believe it's all about the individual having protection of their individual property rights and not being controlled by centralized powers.
At mercy of the government.
But it also leads us to become more responsible. And it means that if your property, your money is not debased away by centralized planners, by central bank, you are able to save that money, and in time that money will gain value over time, and you will be comfortable knowing that in years to come your money will hold more value. Therefore, it will start to lower your time preference, meaning that you will then start to engage in more fulfilling activities, like investing into your culture, investing into your village, into your family, starting a family. You'll be comfortable to actually having more children again. You can actually start to afford to buy a house, and this is why lowering of time preference with a form of money that does not lose value over time is paramount to a healthy society, civilization, and that is how civilizations were birthed. Because the gold standard, we had incredible riches and incredible architecture, incredible art. As soon as the gold standard was taken off, well, the gold standard disappeared because of centralization.
But there was a watered down.
There was watered down, but there was a point in time when the gold standard reached its pinnacle, and we had beautiful constructions of architecture, art. You could see it, and it's replicated. Art replicates life. And nowadays, you see with the art that's coming out, you know, you have bananas sellotaped to the wall, you have urinals on the wall. That's exactly the reflection of what our money is today.
It's interesting. I'm still fascinated by this direct line coming from Friedrich August von Hayek, John Stuart Mill Hayek, and we are now in the middle of Belgrade. Now, there is... Let us talk for a moment about Serbia. You mentioned it before. I mean, you see your family is somehow considers itself guardians of the Serbian spirit. Serbia is a country which is always also in the headlines. You know, in tennis, we have Novak Djokovic, who is like admired tennis player, but he's also, I mean, he's a representative of what you just said. I mean, he speaks up. He doesn't take, you know, any kind of BS from other people.
He is the embodiment of the Serbian character,
right.
Inat character.
Exactly. And you have, also in politics, Serbia is always... is always watched. They say they follow every step that your president is taking. Explain our viewers a bit about the fascination of Serbia. What is Serbia about? You said it's resilience. What are the fascinating traits of your country which you have encountered now since several years since you live here? What is Serbia? What are misunderstandings about Serbia? What is Serbia about? What's the most fascinating thing about Serbia?
I think the most important thing about Serbia is individualism, and that is Serbian Orthodox ideology, and it's about if we protect ourselves and we look after ourselves, and we are able to look after our family. And that's where the birth of the patriarchy comes from. Mm. And this is the idea of very strong family values. Yeah. And this is where a community then grows to become stronger.
Yeah.
We don't if the individual is protected, then the community is protected. Mm-hmm. And not the other way around. Not if we have this collectivization happening, that's been introduced in the West, which we used to have forced upon us here during the communist years. This is what destroys and divides people.
Mm-hmm.
What strengthens people is Serbia's morality and strong family values. And this is something that I've learned more and more as I moved here, as I've lived here over the last few years. Something that wasn't properly taught to me living in the West. Mm-hmm. When I was living in the West in London, I think my ideologies were much more of the new neoliberalism, and I was a little bit, let's say, caught up in the narrative. And now moving to Serbia, I realized that was really not correct.
No.
And that was being slowly stripped away.
Yeah.
And now I understand what the core of living is and life is. It's family, and it's about our generation, the next generations. Looking after our children is number one.
Yeah.
And family, having strong family values is number one. And even Serbia is not immune to this, because this is an issue that we have. And going back to how money is broken, we can't save for to create families. And we've seen the reproduction rate of countries like Serbia, who have strong family values, being destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And we're coming into a demographical crisis. The reproduction rate here is at 1.412, like other parts of the Western world. But if you take the example of strong monarchies in the East, if you look at the Middle Eastern countries, the strongest one and the most stable countries in the Middle East are those of monarchies.
Yeah.
So Qatar, Bahrain, Oman, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and you'll find that they have very high reproduction rates of over 2.1. That means they're not just replacing the population, they're growing the population, because they are true to their ethos of strong family values. Of course, under Islam, but very, very similar to Christianity.
Yeah, yeah. Would you say that actually monarchy is a future model of success? I mean, you could say in Europe we got rid of the monarchies, but in many countries, if you talk to people, they feel a certain nostalgia. Even in Germany, you got these people who think back. I mean, even in spite of all the errors their kings and their emperors made, I mean, there seems to be a certain nostalgia. Is monarchy some kind of a... Could it be a future model? I mean, constitutional monarchy?
I think there is a future monarchy. I don't know if you ever heard of Chesterton's fence. Chesterton was a famous...
I know the writer, but I'm not so much familiar with his old works.
Okay, so Chesterton's fence, more or less, I'll paraphrase him. He says, we don't know what the consequences are of removing that fence.
Mm-hmm.
And that fence, this is basically an analogy saying that fence is could be any tradition.
Yeah, it's like the anchor.
It's like, so yes, so we don't know the dangers of removing what a tradition that to some people may seem old.
Yeah.
What's the word of another thing? Like it's dated, it's antiquated.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we have the erosion and the removal of such antiquated traditions such as monarchy and Christianity.
Yeah.
And when you start to remove these so-called Chesterton, these fences, then all sorts of crazy stuff happens.
Yeah.
And we have the destruction of human identity. We end up getting to the point we are today when some parts of the world, they can't even identify what gender is.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah. I mean, I was just thinking, what you're saying now is like a diagnosis of current times. I mean, if you look in Europe, you get rid of Christianity. There is this progressivism or whatever you call it, progressivism, which is like trying to overwhelm everything. Are we living in crazy times at the moment?
I think we are living through very strange times, through times of weak men that have lost their moral compasses, their values.
Mm-hmm.
And I think now is a time that these weak men have created crazy, hard times. And we can see this with the world moving into some sort of confused state, multipolar at the moment, and we have a lot of different ideologies conflicting against one another, and people talk about this verge of us almost going into World War III. I hope that's not the case, but it shows you that I think obviously it's not the conflict that we're going to get during World War II of a lot of bombs and guns and stuff like that. I think World War III is much more of a cerebral warfare, a much more one of the mind one much more of a psychological warfare.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're living through those times right now, and I think this creates strong men, and strong men are created by going back to what actually worked in the past, and that is having good, strong family moral values, so Christianity, and monarchy is one of those things that we talk about. And I think we can use the examples of what monarchy was in the past as a form, as a uniting form, to help us make decisions going into the future. And I think there's a place for constitutional, and even constitutional monarchies with slightly more power on the monarchy side to have that check on democracies. Because as we've seen right now, democracies are starting to show a lot of their weaknesses. Many famous advocates of democracy, like Descartes, actually. Mm. He was a French
philosopher,
18th century, and he was very pro-democracy, but he even said that democracy should not work beyond a certain amount of population. Now we have democracies working in populations, he said, I think no more than 100,000 people. Now we have these democracies in the tens of millions, hundreds of millions. And that doesn't, make sense to me. And I think we have to go back to some sort of decentralization, something that exists in Switzerland, and something more anarchistic, but understanding what the word anarchistic is, anarchistic view in the Austrian sense of the word, Austrian economic sense of the word. So like what Hayek and Mises were preaching.
Yeah. I mean, do you think we are actually at the moment heading into a new form of Cold War? If you look at the world, I mean, you see, especially, I mean, which is understandable, people are afraid of Russia. They think, well, this is extremely dangerous what they're doing. I mean, what are they doing? So you can understand there is a lot of tension, but it seems almost even more. I mean, are we heading into a new kind of global confrontation?
It's very apparent now, but I think it's to do with propaganda. It's to do with the media, what the mainstream says is what a lot of people follow. But then you have now a movement of people that are becoming aware of this. And we see free speech being clamped down all over the world, censorship happening, being clamped down all over the world.
Yeah.
But we luckily have people like Elon Musk, who's made his platform X or former Twitter platform, open to free speech. Obviously, it's not perfect, and there are still some censorship issues going on there. But this is where people are now getting their information from, is from directly from the source. And I would say I'm an advocate of someone like Tucker Carlson, and I would suggest viewers to go and watch Tucker Carlson's interview with Jeffrey Sachs. And reading Jeffrey Sachs's CV, he is a U.S. diplomat, but has also advised the governments of
Russia, for example. Right,
exactly.
UN Gorbachev, Secretary General.
Right. And he, but he is now realizing the issues that the neocons of America. He will describe what a neocon is, but we're talking about people like Madeleine Albright. I'm talking in what happened here in Serbia. They he said that it was a mistake to bomb Serbia, to bomb Belgrade, a European capital, for 97 straight days in 1999, and that was a precursor to what led to then to the to the illegal recognition of Kosovo as a separate state. And he openly admits to all this, and he, his CV would not, you would read his CV and say he's not that type of person that would actually come to say this. You know, he has, he's into SDGs, he's into environment, into a lot of environmental stuff, but, and he's at Harvard educated, Stanford, I believe, and all that. You'd believe, okay, so he's pretty much a lefty, but no, he's coming clean. And he's showing, telling, and actually he's, I would recommend watching Jeffrey Sachs.
Well, Jeffrey Sachs was also on our program times. I know we had him several times. Tucker Carlson, we are in close contact. It's very interesting. For me, I mean, the question right now is, you see that, especially, I mean, you know the United States of America, you know Great Britain. Those are two countries at the moment who are extremely into this kind of confrontation against the so-called East. You know, it's like it's the narrative. Here we are, the democracies. On the other way, you know, on the other hand, we have the autocracy. We have to defend ourselves as if it was a new Cold War. What could you tell your friends, you know, from Great Britain or the United States, who are probably into that mode? Why are these people wrong? In your view, because why is there a misunderstanding about Russia, about China? Why should we go another path?
Because it's all led by money.
Yeah.
And if you just follow the money with anything, that's where you'll find the truth.
Okay.
And there's, on both sides of the war, it's funded by pretty much the same people in a way. So money is what causes the destruction to keep the war machine happening in America with the neocons.
Yeah.
And obviously, America being the superpower of the world, or it's losing its status as a superpower, but it's still one of the superpowers, is driving these uninformed decisions just for the sake of making money, just to pump the stock price shares of Raytheon and other other war machine stocks. And it's a sad reality that that also drives the media decisions as well, and what the media tells the public, and the media will then vilify some Putin. And I'm not saying Putin is perfect, and I'm not a Putin apologist. And Putin is, you know, he could be part of the problem as well, but it's misunderstood, completely misunderstood. That what's happening in Ukraine is not what is being told in the in Western media.
What's the essence, or here the biggest misunderstanding that is. You know, floating around.
I think firstly, it's a very hypocritical position that the states have taken, especially that with Crimea. If you rewind back to 2014, when the Americans backed a takeover, essentially a coup in Ukraine, the
Yanukovych again. Yanukovych was kicked out.
Yanukovych's government was kicked out, and a pro-US government was put in place. And this is so, and this is what Putin was then saying. This is, hey, this is very contradictory of your position of Kosovo. You know, you do one thing with Kosovo, and you do another thing here in Ukraine.
I mean, this is something that has to be explained. I mean, in Kosovo, it was the other way around. I mean, Kosovo said, we want to be independent. And so they said, we recognize it. And with Crimea, so they said it was all an annexation.
So if you want to be world police, you've got to be consistent. So if you've got to be consistent, then you have to then go back to Kosovo and unrecognize it.
But if you say that to your friends in London, if you what happens then? I mean, they start to attack you, or they listen to you? They think, well, it's reasonable. What do you see?
Depends how open their minds are and how far down the propaganda machine they are. So really, it depends. Some of them will be like, yeah, okay, but you know, but Putin is the next Hitler. Mm-hmm. He must be taken out at all costs. Mm-hmm. At all costs, I say. So you're suggesting World War III? Well, yeah, for anything it takes. Otherwise he's going
to
destroy
the world.
But
it's not us who is going to fight. I mean, of course. I mean, these people, they don't take any weapon into their own hands.
So then you have to remind them about the history of where we are. It's like, so you understand what happened in 1991 after the fall of the Soviet Union, that there was some promises being made that NATO should not expand further east. What happens? NATO started expanding more and more into countries that were former former Russian satellite countries until they reached the red line, and that is, I mean, obviously it's not a member, but they're toying with it, and that is Ukraine membership of NATO, and that is the red
line.
That
was the ultimate red line.
So when they're saying, oh, it was unprovoked attack of Russia attacking Ukraine, that is total and utter BS. Mm-hmm. It is completely provoked by the West, just so they can send some guns and money and just to keep this war machine going on. Mm-hmm. And they tell a different story to the West. This is what Jeffrey Sachs goes on about. Sure, but when you make this known or apparent to your friends in the West, some of them are like, yeah, but you know, this time it's different. Mm-hmm. Tell me how it's different this time. Mm-hmm. You were there against Iraq. You were there against Afghanistan. You were there for these. You were there against Syria. You're there again, maybe against Libya. But now, how is it different? Mm-hmm. It's quite crazy.
And what would you say from your point of view? What has to be done now to get out of this mess?
I think it needs a change of administration in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I think and I hope that Trump wins. Trump is far from perfect. But I think he is definitely the better option of those two, of what we have on offer there. Because Kamala Harris she's not in charge, like Biden was never in charge. Mm-hmm. And they come from more of the neocon side. Whereas Trump, I think he has to be careful how he goes in about it. But I think he will do a better job de-escalating and stopping the war. But hopefully that doesn't come at the cost of doing some trouble here in Kosovo. So I think we need to go and make sure that we educate. And this is what the role of, what could be the role of the royal family, is that we could help the education process of what happened in Kosovo and saying that mistakes were made. And we understand that these mistakes were made during different times, different administrations. But now we have to start with a clean sheet and correct the past. And now is a very good time for this to happen. Because if we continue going down this path that was set out post the fall of the Soviet Union, when we thought the world was going to go be a better place, no, actually it's become even more complicated. Yeah. If we continue going down that path, then yes, certainly some sort of World War III will happen.
Fascinating. What are you saying about the European Union? What's your take on Europe, on the European Union?
I think the European Union was a good idea until it became too powerful and it started issuing directives. I think it should have stopped the economic area. Mm-hmm. I am open to free trade agreements and to open borders, but when it came to actually having a centralized government, unelected officials deciding and then issuing directives to member states, therefore is going against the sovereignty of countries, I think they went too far. Mm-hmm. The Philip, me, of 2016, when Britain voted to leave the Union, I was actually a Remainer. But now, since my ideology and since my education and I've matured a little bit because moving to Serbia, I've realized that maybe that was actually the best decision. Yeah. Not that I'm totally against the EU. I think it still has its merits, but it definitely needs to be reconstructed. Yeah. And I think the euro was the biggest mistake.
Another mistake.
Yes.
They say that Great Britain is suffering terribly because of the Brexit. Is that true?
The bureaucratic process of leaving a union, I'm sure it's very complicated, and but obviously the media is there for a reason, and that's to tell a story. And I think the story is not that complicated. Yeah, people are having a hard time trying to go back to go party in Ibiza with their passports. They have to go wait in a longer queue, but really it's not that much. It's not that terrible. A few deals have to be redrawn and stuff, but there's still free trade essentially.
I mean, I was in Shanghai recently, I was in Moscow recently, in Kiev, and I was impressed by the wealth, by the dynamism. I mean, Moscow, of course, Moscow isn't Russia, but it's incredible what they are doing. I see Shanghai. I mean, after the sanctions of the US, you have the impression that the Chinese are doubling down. I mean, they made huge technological progress. Coming back to Europe,
They
I
have
have this
made,
strange
yes.
feeling that we are like in a kind of retarded area in decline. You know, you see Germany, where the economy is like in a very difficult shape. You see France, where the government is hanging in the ropes. I mean, there is some scary impression if you look at Europe vis-a-vis these
Yes,
powerhouses. What's
I've
your take
written
here?
about this before. Europe, given its population, given its wealth, you would expect it to be leading in the world in something, in IT, for example, or in anything, some sort of manufacturing, something, but it's not. I don't see any of the top 10, I don't think I see one top 10 IT company coming from Europe. This is an issue with the regulations that they're imposing on themselves. There's some good regulations that they do, maybe, let's just say, some, I will not call all, but some environmental regulations in terms of cleaning up dirty energy, their coal. But their ardent push for other, let's call it more inefficient forms of clean energy, like solar and wind, especially wind, that these are not good base load energy, and they are subsidizing these projects over, let's say, something like nuclear. This is destroying our Europe's energy structure. And I see it in Germany, that Germany's dependence on Russia was something that was something that Trump actually once in 2018 actually called them out and said, "You're too dependent on Russian energy." And what happened a few years later is that the new war happened, and then the ties were severed, and Germany now is suffering because they can't get that cheap gas from Russia, and also the Americans blew up Nord Stream 2. So it's absolutely crazy. Then you would find that Germany, okay, so you have potential for good nuclear energy, but what did they do? They chose coal over nuclear, which is absolute madness. And then on top of that, Europe is highly regulated, so you ended up having the innovations of Europe is things like paper straws and new bottle caps instead of other advancements that you see in China and even in America.
No, I was thinking of something you said before. I mean, this world where you start to destroy stuff which was good.
Yes.
People are running around somehow hypnotized by these arch enemies, so-called arch enemies of our society. We're in a state of permanent frenzy. And probably you are right. I mean, this could be the effect of a society who has lost the ground under its feet.
Correct.
I mean, we got rid of religion, we got rid of tradition. I mean, everybody who cleans his teeth in the morning is considered a right-wing extremist. I mean, if you wear a tie, probably
If you go,
you're already watched, you
if you
know.
go to the gym,
If
if
you
you
go to
look
the
up,
gym, you seem to be already a right-wing radical. I mean, how to get out of this world? I mean, or where is the silver lining
I mean,
in this situation?
I mean, that's a very good question. I don't think we quite know the answer to that yet, but I think I know that more people are awakening to the fact of this, I would say, nonsensical, senseless policies that are coming out from the West, and people are realizing that they make no sense. And really, if you just take a step back, you actually realize that it's that more damage has been done than good. Yeah. And I think people are becoming awake to that.
But there are countries, to name a few, Serbia, Hungary, even, I mean, you can, of course, there are differences. Poland, you can, I would say, so-called Eastern European countries, which consider themselves Central European countries, they seem to be much less affected.
Because they went through
this.
It in the communist years. So they know when they've been propagandized. They know what propaganda, they know what communism is.
Yeah.
And now they're seeing it, and they're seeing it happening in a different way, obviously in the form of, let's call it, cultural Marxism, with all the DEI, LGBT, all these sort of policies are being forced onto the public. Yeah. But we are aware of that because it's something similar happened to us in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I respect Serbia's position of its neutrality, a little bit like Switzerland's position. And we have to hold on to that neutrality and not join any massive clubs like NATO or European. Not that I'm against the EU in that sense. Yeah. I think EU can be cleaned up and then maybe we can talk.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as I said, but...
I
think that countries like Poland, as you talked about, Hungary, with President, what's his name?
Orban.
Orban.
Prime Minister Orban.
Yeah, Prime Minister Orban are fully aware of what's going on because they have populations that have gone through this.
To finish up our conversation, thank you very much again, very interesting. What can the so-called West, I mean, let's say what, Brussels, I mean the country within in the western part of Europe, what can they learn from Serbia? What would you say is something that could be adapted? For example, I mean, you have close ties to China, you work together with Russia, but also with Western countries. What is the message there from Serbia? What can we learn from Serbia?
I think Serbia's neutrality is something that these countries can learn, and not to blindly follow bigger powers. Mm-hmm. Because you're bullied into that.
Yeah.
I think you've got to show a little bit more, of your muscle. Mm-hmm. You know, a country as
Serbian resilience.
Serbian resilience. I think a country as small as Brussels can really flex its muscles. Mm-hmm. You know, the muscles from Brussels.
well, you know, but then you do they have so many muscles in Brussels?
That's
I don't
the
know.
Thing. They need to start working out more. But this is the same with, you know, with Spain, and I think Spain sometimes shows its muscles. You know, by not recognizing Kosovo.
Yeah.
I understand that's because of its Catalonia problem, but they're standing strong on that.
Yeah.
I think France has many, many issues, but they can come there. They have the population that is that are very good at creating revolution, so there's hope there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not talking about a revolution, I'm not talking some uprising, I'm just saying that we should be more open-minded.
Yeah.
And I think that's one thing that Serbs are. We are very open-minded people, but also we are also very very traditionalist.
Yeah.
We are very moral people. We understand everyone has a different understanding of what right and wrong is.
Yeah.
But because through our Christian teachings, our Orthodox teachings, that has helped us guide us to to give us hopefully a moral compass that leads us in a way in a peaceful and truthful way.
What is fascinating about Serbia for me, I mean, this is the second time I'm in Belgrade, when I was at the castle at the center of town, you have here the rivers, you know, flowing through Belgrade, and you realize that actually we are here in the heart of Europe, but it has always been a place where there was a clash of civilizations. So you had to,
on one hand, you had
to defend your own identity. On the other hand, you had to coexist with other identities.
So this is
an interesting aspect of your...
My great-grandfather, King Alexander, was known as the Unifier. And he created Yugoslavia. First, it was... the kingdom of Serbian, Slovene, Croats, and Slovenes, and this was in at the end of the First World War when the Austro-Hungarian powers were starting to diminish, and Slovenia and Croatia wanted to be under Serbian, like a protectorate, and together we were stronger.
Yeah.
That then grew to become Yugoslavia, and then incorporated Bosnia and Herzegovina and Macedonia and Montenegro. And he unified these countries under the crown. But also, it was not just okay, one crown, one religion. No, he allowed the different the different religions to operate. And he has a famous act in the constitution that means that all religions are free to practice their religions, and all people are free to be who they want to be respect. And he was very loved king for that respect. But then Yugoslavia fell. The idea of Yugoslavia fell into the communist hands, and this was post Second World War. We talked about that that the decision was made that Yugoslavia would be under the Stalin, under the Russian and communist.
And the West started to help the communists, basically.
Exactly. So Yugoslavia, post-Second World War, was actually a project that was helped by the West. 60 to 70% of our trade came from the West. It was the West money that kept Yugoslavia alive.
Yeah.
And Tito, that was Tito's idea of Yugoslavia. But of course, Tito, they, not being a monarch, had no succession plan, and this is where a monarchy has a royal family has an advantage, is it has a succession plan and it thinks about generations ahead.
It's interesting. Do you think that there would have been a chance to hold Yugoslavia together, or was it already impossible because of the tragedy of the Second World War and the communism?
One thing's for sure. I think we wouldn't. King Alexander wouldn't have been blamed today. People blame King Alexander today for the problems that were experienced in the '90s, which is a little bit, I think, dumb. But okay, so I think if Yugoslavia had remained a kingdom. And this was the issue. I think the reason why maybe some of these larger powers to be didn't want Yugoslavia to remain as a kingdom is because as a kingdom itself it was like a small empire.
Yeah.
And it was a strong asset building, strong independent empire, which was a little bit like a threat to the other Axis powers.
Okay.
So had that remained, I think over time you would have maybe seen Croatia and Slovenia and Macedonia leaving, but it would not have been as bloody or as horrible as what we experienced in the 90s, because we would have had a strong, stable government held by the crown, which would have had a continuation and a sense of unity, and there would have been discussions of maybe giving Croatia more autonomy. Kosovo even would have had more autonomy. Macedonia, Bosnia, as well, of course, Bosnia. And all this, it would have been done in a much more peaceful manner. And I think Yugoslavia might not have existed today like it did in the past, but there would have been some sort of unity because Montenegro and Serbs are very similar in culture and stuff. So it would have held together in a much more peaceful way. And the horrible things that happened in the 90s would have been completely avoided.
Yeah. Well, the ways of history. Your Royal Highness, dear Hereditary Prince Philip, it was great talking to you. Many thanks for your insightful remarks here, and thanks again for having us here in your fantastic White Palace.
It's been a pleasure to speak to you, too. Really, I thoroughly enjoyed my conversation with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All the best to you. And meine Damen und Herren, mit diesen versöhnlichen Gesten und Worten verabschieden wir uns für heute. Wir haben eine hochinteressante, auch geschichtliche Exkursion zum Schluss noch gehört und viele eben jener faszinierenden Gedanken, die man in der heutigen Zeit, I'm just explaining why it is so fascinating, man hört diese Gedanken einfach zum Teil in unseren Mainstream-Gefilden nicht so sehr. Und deshalb ist es eben schön, auch in Länder zu gehen, in denen eben noch dieser Widerstandsgeist, diese Resilienz, wie Sie gesagt haben, vorhanden ist. Auf jeden Fall danken wir Ihnen sehr herzlich für die Aufmerksamkeit. Wir verabschieden uns und wünschen der jungen Familie des Erbprinzen, seine Frau sitzt uns übrigens hier gegenüber, die kleine Tochter hier ganz still, noch in einem kleinen Kinderwagen, der Älteste, der Junge, der scheint da in anderen Teilen des Anwesens unterwegs zu sein. Also Sie sehen hier, selbst in Palastumgebung herrschen eben die Realitäten einer jungen Familie, wo man in der Mangelung eines Babysitters eben auch selber schauen muss, dass die Kinder da nicht aus dem Ruder laufen. Vielen Dank, wir sehen uns und bleiben Sie dran. Wir melden uns auf jeden Fall zurück.